which I look upon as the salvation of the Republic, it is well. I hope you will concur with the views I have taken. The true interests of the country require the re-election of Lincoln." Frank eventually did concur with his father, though, like his brother, he at first found it somewhat mortifying to reflect that this triumph has been given to those who are equally the enemies of the President and the Blairs. On the other hand, he was certain that a failure to re-elect Mr. Lincoln would be the greatest disaster that could befall the country, and the sacrifice made by Monty to avert this is so incomparably small that I felt it would not cost him a penny to make. Elizabeth Blair, hearing the noble sentiments of the men, believed that she and Monty's wife, Minna, were more hurt than anybody else. As far as Monty's loyal sister was concerned, Lincoln should have stuck with his first view of the poor policy of sacrificing his friends to his enemies. She was impressed, however, by her brother's fine, manly bearing, which he illustrated repeatedly in the days ahead as he took to the stump on behalf of Abraham Lincoln. Speaking to large conservative gatherings, Monty insisted that the request for his resignation had not proceeded from any unkindness on Lincoln's part. On the contrary, the President has at least the support of those who are nearer to me than all other people on this earth. I retired by the recommendation of my own father to the President. John Hay returned from Illinois just at the time of Blair's resignation. He noted that Blair was behaving very handsomely and is doing his utmost to re-elect Lincoln. Monty would never forget that Lincoln had stood by him after the mortifying publication of his private letter to Fremont 3 years earlier, which contained passages demeaning the President. He knew that his father had never been turned away when he requested a private audience with Lincoln, and that his sister, Elizabeth, was always welcome at the White House. His entire family would forever appreciate Lincoln's support for Frank during his continuing battle with the radicals in Congress. Indeed, Lincoln's countless acts of generosity and kindness had cemented a powerful connection with the close-knit Blair family that even Monty's forced resignation could not break. In the end, Lincoln gained the withdrawal of Fremont and the backing of the radicals without losing the affection and support of the conservative and powerful Blairs. Both Republicans and Democrats considered the state elections in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Indiana on October 11th harbingers of the presidential election in November. Not only would the results reveal public sentiment, but the party that gained the governor's offices in those states would have a grand central rallying point for its partisans. That evening, Lincoln made his customary visit to the telegraph office in the War Department to read the dispatches as they came over the wire. Stanton was there, as was his assistant secretary, Charles Dana, and Thomas Eckert, chief of the telegraph office. Early reports from Cincinnati and Philadelphia looked hopeful, but reliable figures were unbearably slow in coming. To defuse the tension, Dana recalled, Lincoln took from his pocket a thin, yellow-covered pamphlet containing the latest writings of the humorist Petroleum V. Nasby. He would read a page or a story, pause to consider a new election telegram, and then open the book again and go ahead with a new passage. John Hay, who had accompanied Lincoln, found the selections immensely amusing, and mistakenly thought Stanton felt the same way. During a break in the readings, however, the solemn war secretary signaled Dana to follow him into the adjoining room. "I shall never forget," Dana later recalled, "the fire of his indignation at what seemed to him to be mere nonsense." Stanton found it incomprehensible that, when the safety of the Republic was thus at issue, when the control of an empire was to be determined by a few figures brought in by the telegraph, the leader, the man most deeply concerned, not merely for himself but for his country, could turn aside to read such balderdash, and to laugh at such frivolous jests. Stanton never would understand the indispensable role that laughter played in sustaining Lincoln's spirits in difficult times. As the night wore on, the news from Ohio and Indiana proved better than anyone expected. The Republicans in Ohio gained 12 congressional seats, and the state provided a 50,000-vote Republican majority. In Indiana, the Republican candidate for governor, Oliver Morton, won by a large margin, and Republicans captured 8 of the 11 congressional seats. The results in Pennsylvania were less decisive. Sometime after midnight, Lincoln sent a telegram to Simon Cameron. "I'm leaving office to go home," he wrote. "How does it stand now?" No answer was received from Cameron, which seemed ominous to Hay. It turned out that the margin was so close that neither party could declare victory. Only when the absentee soldier vote was tallied in the days ahead could the Republicans claim a slight margin. Wells observed that Seward was quite exultant over the elections, feels strong and self-gratified, says this administration is wise, energetic, faithful, and able beyond any of its predecessors, that it has gone through trials which none of them has ever known. Lincoln, characteristically, reacted with more caution than his debonair colleague. Though delighted by Ohio and Indiana, he found the close vote in Pennsylvania sobering. 2 nights after the state elections, appearing unusually weary, Lincoln returned to the telegraph office in the War Department to calculate the probability of his election in November. Taking a blank sheet of telegraph paper, he made 2 neat columns. The one on the left represented his estimate of the electoral votes McClellan would win. The one on the right tabulated the states he thought would be his. The cipher operator, David Homer Bates, noted that he wrote slowly and deliberately, stopping at times in thoughtful mood to look out of the window for a moment or two, and then resuming his writing. The president guessed he would lose both New York and Pennsylvania, which meant his best hope was to squeak through by a total of only 3 electoral votes, 117 to 114. If these calculations were correct, he lamented, the moral effect of his triumph would be broken, and his power to prosecute the war and make peace would be greatly impaired. During the anxious 4-week period that stretched between the state and presidential elections, Lincoln received the heartening news that voters in Maryland had ratified a new constitution, officially terminating slavery in their state. The margin had been perilously close, with the absentee soldier vote making the difference. "Most heartily do I congratulate you, and Maryland, and the nation, and the world, upon the event," Lincoln told a group of serenaders. Speaking that same day with Noah Brooks, he said, "I had rather have Maryland upon that issue than have a state twice its size upon the presidential issue. It cleans up a piece of ground." Brooks admired the frank homeliness of Lincoln's choice of words. "Anyone who has ever had to do with cleaning up a piece of ground, digging out vicious roots and demolishing old stumps, can appreciate the homely simile applied to Maryland, where slavery has just been cleaned up effectually." It was clear to both parties that the absentee vote could prove critical in the presidential election. Democrats, remembering the fanatical devotion McClellan had inspired among his men, believed their man would receive an overwhelming majority of the soldier vote. "We are as certain of 2/3 of that vote for General McClellan as that the sun shines," the Democratic publisher Manton Marble jauntily predicted. Lincoln thought differently. He trusted the bond he had developed with his soldiers during his many trips to the front. After every defeat, he had joined them, riding slowly along their lines, boosting their spirits. He had wandered companionably through their encampments, fascinated by the smallest details of camp life. Sitting with the wounded in hospital tents, he had taken their hands and wished them well. The humorous stories he had told clusters of soldiers had been retold to hundreds more. The historian William Davis estimates that 250,000 or more had had some glimpse of him on their own. In addition, word of his pardons to soldiers who had fallen asleep on picket duty or exhibited fear in the midst of battle had spread through the ranks. Most important of all, through his eloquent speeches and public letters, he had given profound meaning to the struggle for which they were risking their lives. Provisions for soldiers to cast absentee ballots in the field had recently been introduced in 13 states. 4 other states allowed soldiers to vote by proxy, placing their ballots in a sealed envelope to be sent or carried for deposit in their hometowns. In several crucial states, however, soldiers still had to be in their hometowns on election day to cast their ballots. In an attempt to remedy this situation before the October state elections, Lincoln had wired General Sherman about Indiana, whose soldiers cannot vote in the field. "Anything you can safely do to let her soldiers or any part of them go home and vote at the state election will be greatly in point." He emphasized that this is in no sense an order, but merely a request. Stanton followed up, making certain that furloughs were liberally granted wherever possible. All the power and influence of the War Department was employed to secure the re-election of Mr. Lincoln, Charles Dana later asserted. When Thurlow Weed alerted the White House that among the sailors on gunboats along the Mississippi, there were several thousand New Yorkers ready to vote if the government could provide a steamer to reach them and gather their ballots, Lincoln asked Wells to put a Navy boat at the disposal of the New York Commission to gather votes. As the election drew close, Lincoln told a visitor, "I would rather be defeated with the soldier vote behind me than to be elected without it." It is likely that McClellan shared Lincoln's sentiment. The election would tell which man had won the hearts and minds of the more than 850,000 men who were fighting for the Union. On Election Day, November 8, 1864, the New York Times editorialized that, "Before this morning's sun sets, the destinies of this republic, so far as depends on human agency, are to be settled for weal or for woe." To elect Lincoln was to choose war, tremendous and terrible, yet ushering in at the end every national security and glory. To choose McClellan was to choose the mocking shadow of a peace, sure to rob us of our birthright, and to entail upon our children a dissevered union and ceaseless strife. In Washington, it was dark and rainy. Arriving at the White House about noon, Noah Brooks was surprised to find the president entirely alone. Seward and Usher had gone home to vote, as had William Dennison, Blair's replacement as Postmaster General. This would be the 10th time Seward had cast a presidential ballot in Auburn. He had voted in more than half of the 19 presidential elections since the beginning of the country. Fessenden was in New York working out the details of a new government loan, while Stanton was at home with a fever. Lincoln could not vote that day, for Illinois required voters to be present in the state. Lincoln felt no need to conceal his anxiety from Brooks. I am just enough of a politician to know that there was not much doubt about the result of the Baltimore Convention. But about this thing, I am very far from being certain. I wish I were certain." Brooks remained with Lincoln through most of the afternoon, noting that the president found it difficult to put his mind on any of the routine work of his office. The only respite he found was in telling a humorous story about Tad, whose pet turkey apparently roamed at will among the Pennsylvania soldiers quartered at the White House. When the day had come for the bucktail soldiers to cast their absentee ballots before their state's commission, Tad had excitedly rushed into his father's office so they could watch the voting from the window. Teasing his son, Lincoln had asked if the turkey, too, intended to vote. Tad's clever reply delighted his father. "No," he said, "he is not of age." Brooks noted that Lincoln so dearly loved the boy that for days thereafter he took pride in relating this anecdote illustrative of Tad's quick-wittedness. As the clock struck 7, the president, accompanied by John Hay, walked over to the telegraph office to begin the long vigil. "It is a little singular," Lincoln remarked to Hay, "that I, who am not a vindictive man, should have always been before the people for election in canvases marked for their bitterness." The lights of the War Department, bursting with dozens of orderlies and clerks, provided a welcome contrast to the murky night. The muddy grounds had caused Thomas Eckert to fall on his face, which, of course, Hay noted, reminded the tycoon of a story. "For such an awkward fellow," Lincoln began, "I am pretty sure-footed. It used to take a pretty dexterous man to throw me. I remember the evening of the day in 1858 that decided the contest for the Senate between Mr. Douglas and myself was something like this, dark, rainy, and gloomy. I had been reading the returns and had ascertained that we had lost the legislature and started to go home. The path had been worn hog-backed and was slippering. My foot slipped from under me, knocking the other one out of the way, but I recovered myself and lit square. And I said to myself, 'It's a slip and not a fall.'" Even at the time, Lincoln had understood that his defeat for the Senate was a slip and not a fall. Little could he then have imagined, however, that on another dreary night, 6 years later, he would be waiting to hear if he had been elected to a second presidential term. The early returns were positive, revealing larger Republican majorities than in the state elections. Lincoln asked to have the good news carried to Mary at the White House. "She is more anxious than I," he commented. Shortly afterward, Wells and Fox arrived. Fox was thrilled to hear that Winter Davis had been defeated in Maryland. "You have more of that feeling of personal resentment than I," Lincoln said. "A man has not time to spend half his life in quarrels. If any man ceases to attack me, I never remember the past against him." The returns, including those from Pennsylvania, continued to be promising, though New York, with its large number of traditionally Democratic Irish immigrants, remained in doubt. By the hour of midnight, however, when a supper of fried oysters was served, Lincoln's victory was assured, though his lopsided Electoral College win would not be known for several days. In the end, he would win all but 3 states, New Jersey, Delaware, and Kentucky, giving him 212 electoral votes against McClellan's 21. The popular vote was closer. The two candidates were separated by about 400,000 votes. Nonetheless, the results were far better than Lincoln had predicted. The Republican Union Party had gained 37 seats in Congress and placed 12 governors in office. It had also seized control of most of the state legislatures with the power to name the next round of U.S. senators. It was after 2 a.m. when Lincoln left the telegraph office. The rain had stopped, and along Pennsylvania Avenue, an impromptu crowd had gathered, singing the battle cry of freedom at the tops of their voices. As he went to sleep that night, Lincoln carried with him the knowledge, as Brooks put it, that the verdict of the people was likely to be so full, clear, and unmistakable that there could be no dispute, thereby affording him the chance to continue the war until both liberty and union were secured. Most impressive, the soldier vote had swung overwhelmingly in his favor. In the armies of the West, he won 8 out of 10 votes, and even in McClellan's Army of the Potomac, Lincoln earned the votes of 7 out of every 10 soldiers. Many of these soldiers still admired McClellan, but could not countenance the defeatist Democratic platform, or the fact that the Confederacy was obviously hoping the young Napoleon would win. But there was something else, something Democrats had failed to understand. Over the years, Lincoln had inspired an almost mystical devotion among his troops. The men had come to regard Mr. Lincoln with sentiments of veneration and love, noted an Illinois corporal. To them, he really was Father Abraham, with all that the term implied. By supporting Lincoln, the soldiers understood that they were voting to prolong the war, but they voted with their hearts for the president they loved and the cause that he embodied. Chapter 25. A Sacred Effort. On Thursday night, November 10th, 1864, an immense crowd, gay with banners and resplendent with lanterns, gathered on the White House lawn to congratulate the president on his re-election. Martial music, the cheers of people, and the roar of cannon shook the sky. When the joyful throng demanded his appearance, Lincoln spoke to the crowd from a second-floor window, acknowledging that the recent canvass had been marred by undesirable strife. He nonetheless felt it had demonstrated that a people's government can sustain a national election in the midst of a great civil war. Until now, it has not been known to the world that this was a possibility. When Lincoln drew his little speech to a close, the revelers moved on to Seward's Lafayette Square home. They found the Secretary of State, who had just returned from Auburn, in an exceedingly jocose frame of mind. He predicted that the time was near when we will all come together again, when the stars and stripes wave over Richmond. And you will have to look mighty sharp to find a man who was a secessionist or an aider of the rebellion. He recollected that when he was a boy in the early 1800s, his parents had told of the vast number of Tories who opposed the government during the American Revolution. Yet, 30 years later, there was not a Tory to be found in the whole United States. Seward's good humor infected the crowd, who responded with cheers and laughter. In closing, he observed that the night was young. I advise you to go and see Mr. Fessenden, for if he gets discouraged, we shall all come to grief. Also, be good enough to poke up Mr. Stanton. He needs poking up, for he has been seriously sick, I hear, for several days past. You cannot do better also than to call upon my excellent friend Gideon Wells, and ask him if he cannot make the blockade off Wilmington more stringent, so that I shall not need to have so much trouble with my foreign relations. Seward's playful remarks about his colleagues reflected the improved atmosphere in the cabinet now that Chase and Blair were gone. Both men had symbolized the animosity between radicals and conservatives in the country at large. Their clashing emotions had long reverberated through the cabinet. The periodic jealousy Wells felt over the superior access Seward and Stanton enjoyed with the president had been intensified 100-fold so long as Blair was there to fuel the flames. Likewise, when Stanton was angry with Lincoln over pardons or appointments, Chase had eagerly lent an approving ear to his complaints. Never initiated into this contentious drama, Fessenden and Dennison brought cooperation and amity to the cabinet. Strife abated, and Wells even acknowledged that his relations with Seward had grown more amicable, and that Stanton was sounding more reasonable and less radical regarding Reconstruction. Rumor-mongers had speculated that Lincoln would now want to replace his entire cabinet. It was positively asserted that Seward would give way to Charles Francis Adams, that General Butler would replace Stanton, and that Wells and Bates had outlived their usefulness. It was surmised that Lincoln would prefer more controllable colleagues. The busy, hypothetical cabinet-makers did not understand that Lincoln had no wish to disturb the rhythm of his relationships with his colleagues, which, to his mind, worked exceedingly well. Lincoln's friendship with Seward had deepened with each passing year. "His confidence in Seward is great," observed Wells that autumn. "Seward spends more or less of every day with the President." On subjects of the gravest importance, Seward was the President's only confidant and adviser. Whenever Lincoln bounced an idea off Seward, he received straightforward advice. When a plan to foster Union sentiment in the South, through confidential government purchase of a controlling share in a number of failing Southern newspapers, was presented to Lincoln, he turned to Seward for advice. "It seems to me very judicious and wise," Seward responded. "It would provide a forum for Union men to help sway the opinion of fellow Southerners. If government funds were not readily available, he suggested that Thurlow Weed might find money by contribution." Though some still considered the talkative New Yorker the power behind the throne, Seward had long since understood that Lincoln was the master. "There is but one vote in the cabinet," asserted Seward, "and that is cast by the President." 2 days after the election, Seward told a crowd of supporters, "Henceforth all men will come to see him, as you and I have seen him. Abraham Lincoln will take his place with Washington and Franklin and Jefferson and Adams and Jackson among the benefactors of the country and of the human race." Lincoln's partnership with his volatile Secretary of War, though not as intimate and leisurely, was equally effective. Stanton was only 50 in the fall of 1864, but he looked older, his clerk Benjamin recalled, by reason of the abundant tinging of his originally brown hair and beard with iron gray. The war had taken a toll on his constitution, already weakened by the lifelong struggle with asthma that caused periodic fits of strangulation. The illness that kept him in bed on election eve lasted for nearly 3 weeks. For a time it seemed he would not rally. His doctor begged him to take a leave of absence from his post. "Barnes," Stanton replied, "keep me alive till this rebellion is over, and then I will take a rest. A long one, perhaps." In a letter to Chase, written shortly after Lincoln's re-election, he acknowledged that his health could be restored only by absolute rest and relief from labor and care, though nothing could keep him from his post until he had brought the soldiers home in peace. By late November, Stanton was back working 15-hour days at his stand-up desk, directing his subordinates with a steely determination. The complex relationship between the President and his Secretary of War was not easy to comprehend. At times, it seemed as if Stanton controlled the President. At other times, it was clear that Lincoln was the dominant force in dictating policy. In fact, there was an unwritten code between the two powerful men. Each could veto the other's acts, but Lincoln was to rule when he felt it necessary. Lincoln used his veto over Stanton sparingly, as two of his congressional friends learned to their dismay. Having obtained the President's assent to a military appointment for one of their constituents, they carried the endorsed application to Stanton. Stanton flatly refused to consider it. "The position is of high importance," Stanton explained. "I have in mind a man of suitable experience and capacity to fill it." When informed that Lincoln wanted this man, Stanton bellowed, I do not care what the president wants. The country wants the very best it can get. I am serving the country, regardless of individuals. The two congressmen walked back to the White House, assuming the president would override his secretary, but Lincoln refused. Gentlemen, it is my duty to submit. I cannot add to Mr. Stanton's troubles. His position is one of the most difficult in the world. Thousands in the army blame him because they are not promoted, and other thousands out of the army blame him because they are not appointed. The pressure upon him is immeasurable and unending. He is the rock on the beach of our national ocean, against which the breakers dash and roar without ceasing. He fights back the angry waters and prevents them from undermining and overwhelming the land. Gentlemen, I do not see how he survives, why he is not crushed and torn to pieces. Without him, I should be destroyed. He performs his task superhumanly. Now, do not mind this matter, for Mr. Stanton is right, and I cannot wrongly interfere with him. At the same time, Lincoln expected Stanton to be aware of the special burdens he faced as president. For weeks, Lincoln wrote Stanton, he had been pressed by relatives of prisoners of war in our custody, whose homes are within our lines, and who wished to take the oath and be discharged. He believed that taking the oath was an act of honor, that none of them will again go to the rebellion, though he acknowledged that the rebellion again coming to them, a considerable percentage of them, probably not a majority, would rejoin it. With a cautious discrimination, however, the number so discharged would not be large enough to do any considerable mischief. Moreover, looking forward to the day when the two sides would once again be united, he thought the government should avoid planting and cultivating too many thorns in the bosom of society. With all these considerations in mind, it would prove relief from an intolerable pressure if he could have Stanton's cheerful assent to the discharge of those names I may send, which I will only do with circumspection. Stanton replied the following day, "Your order for the discharge of any prisoners of war will be cheerfully and promptly obeyed." Lincoln's liberal use of his pardoning power created the greatest tension between the two men. Stanton felt compelled to protect military discipline by exacting proper punishment for desertions or derelictions of duty, while Lincoln looked for any good excuse for saving a man's life. When he found one, he said, "I go to bed happy, as I think how joyous the signing of my name will make him and his family and his friends." Stanton would not allow himself such leniency. A clerk recalled finding Stanton one night in his office. The mother, wife, and children of a soldier who had been condemned to be shot as a deserter on their knees before him, pleading for the life of their loved one. He listened, standing, in cold and austere silence, and at the end of their heartbreaking sobs and prayers, answered briefly that the man must die. The crushed and despairing little family left, and Mr. Stanton turned, apparently unmoved, and walked into his private room. The clerk thought Stanton an unfeeling tyrant, until he discovered him moments later, leaning over a desk, his face buried in his hands, and his heavy frame shaking with sobs. "God help me to do my duty, God help me to do my duty," he was repeating in a low wail of anguish. On such occasions, when Stanton felt he could not afford to set a precedent, he must have been secretly relieved that the president had the ultimate authority. When Stanton thought he was right, however, he tenaciously pursued his purpose. When a group of Pennsylvania politicians received the president's assent for discharging some prisoners of war in their district, who were willing to take the oath and join the Union Army fighting Indians in the West, Stanton flatly refused to execute the order. The order specified that the discharged prisoners would receive a bounty, and be credited against Pennsylvania's draft quota, thus reducing the number of troops required of the Keystone State. "Mr. President, I cannot do it," he asserted. "The order is an improper one, and I cannot execute it." Lincoln was equally firm in his reply, "Mr. Secretary, it will have to be done." And so it was. When the order was publicized, a storm of criticism descended upon Stanton. To give a bounty to soldiers who were already in government custody seemed wasteful and wrong, as did counting the discharged prisoners against the quota that Pennsylvania, like every other state, was required to supply. Lincoln learned that Grant, too, was unhappy and blamed Stanton. "I send this," Lincoln promptly wrote Grant, "to do justice to the Secretary of War." He then explained that he had responded to the idea upon pressing application, and the thing went so far before it came to the knowledge of the Secretary of War that, in my judgment, it could not be abandoned without greater evil than would follow its going through. I did not know at the time that you had protested against that class of thing being done, and I now say that while this particular job must be completed, no other of the sort will be authorized without an understanding with you, if at all. The Secretary of War is wholly free of any part in this blunder. In this instance, Stanton was transparently blameless, but Lincoln protected his volatile secretary even when criticism was justified, when his firmness degenerated at times into sheer obstinacy, his enthusiasm into intolerance, his strength of will into arrogance. Even the equitable George Templeton Strong acknowledged that it was hard to vote for sustaining an administration of which Stanton is a member. He is a ruffian. Implacable and abrasive as Stanton could be, his scrupulous honesty, energy, and determination were invaluable to Lincoln. When one caller complained bitterly about Stanton's bearish style, Lincoln stopped him cold. "Go home, my friend, and read attentively the 10th verse of the 30th chapter of Proverbs." The verse reads as follows: "Accuse not a servant to his master, lest he curse thee, and then be found guilty." When people speculated about cabinet changes after his re-election, Lincoln made it clear that Stanton would not be leaving. "Folks come up here and tell me that there are a great many men in the country who have all Stanton's excellent qualities without his defects," he commented. "All I have to say is, I haven't met 'em. I don't know 'em." Nor did Lincoln consider dismissing his Neptune, Gideon Wells. Reserved by nature, Wells did not enjoy the easy camaraderie with Lincoln that Seward did. The discreet New Englander looked askance at the curious pleasure both Lincoln and Seward took in talking with the little newsmongers and hearing all the political gossip. And he was often vexed by the odd intimacy between Lincoln and Stanton. Unlike Chase, however, he confined his complaints to his diary and remained totally loyal to the president, whose natural sagacity he greatly admired. Moreover, Lincoln recognized that Wells had accomplished a Herculean task. He had built a navy almost from scratch, utterly revamping a department initially paralyzed by subversion and strife. Even the normally critical Times of London was forced to concede the extraordinary growth of the American Navy under the leadership of Gideon Wells. When Wells took office, there were only 76 vessels flying the American flag. 4 years later, there were 671. The number of seamen had increased from 7,600 to 51,000. In the span of only 4 years, the American Navy had become a first-class power. A shrewd judge of character, Wells had assembled an excellent team, including his dynamic assistant secretary, Gustavus Vassa Fox, and the industrious commandant of the Navy Yard, John Dahlgren. Welles had opposed the blockade, but once overruled, had enforced it with determination and skill. He had fought Lincoln on the admission of West Virginia as a state and the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, but he had never publicly vented his objections. With Seward, Stanton, and Welles secure in their cabinet places, the resignation of Edward Bates provided the only opening for change in the immediate aftermath of the election. The 71-year-old Bates had contemplated resigning the previous spring after suffering through a winter of chronic illness. In May, his son Barton had pleaded with him to return to St. Louis. "The situation of affairs is such that you are not required to sacrifice your health and comfort for any good which you may possibly do," urged Barton. "As to pecuniary matters, I know well that you have but little to fall back on. For the present, at least, make your home at my house and Julian's, going from one to the other as suits your convenience. You've done your share of work, anyhow, and it is time the youngsters were working for you. If you had nothing at all, Julian and I could continue to take good care of you and Ma and the girls, and you know that we would do it as cheerfully as you ever worked for us, and we would greatly prefer to do it, rather than you should be wearing yourself out, as now, with labor and cares unsuited to your age." The prospect of going home to children and grandchildren was attractive, especially to Julia Bates, whose wishes remained paramount with her husband after 41 years of marriage. On their anniversary in late May, Bates happily noted that "our mutual affection is as warm and our mutual confidence far stronger than in the first week of marriage. This is God's blessing." However, during the dark period that preceded the fall of Atlanta, when Bates believed the fate of the nation hung in doubt and gloom, he did not feel he could leave his post. Nor did he wish to depart until Lincoln's re-election was assured. "Now, on the contrary," he wrote to Lincoln on November 24, 1864, "the affairs of the government display a brighter aspect, and to you, as head and leader of the government, all the honor and good fortune that we hoped for has come. And it seems to me, under these altered circumstances, that the time has come when I may, without dereliction of duty, ask leave to retire to private life." Bates went on to express his profound gratitude to Lincoln, "not only for your good opinion, which led to my appointment, but also for your uniform and unvarying courtesy and kindness during the whole time in which we have been associated in the public service. The memory of that kindness and personal favor I shall bear with me into private life, and hope to retain in my heart as long as I live." Bates had served his president and his country faithfully. In his first months as Attorney General, though he had been uncomfortable confronting Justice Taney on the issue of arbitrary arrests, he had composed an elaborate opinion justifying Lincoln's suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. When McClellan had refused to divulge his plans in early 1862, Bates had urged Lincoln to assume control of his commanders, advising him that the authority of the presidency stood above that of his generals, even on military matters. When the president read his first draft of the Emancipation Proclamation to the cabinet in July 1862, Bates had been one of the first to speak favorably. Though Bates never fully escaped from the racial prejudices formed in his early years, he continued to believe until the end of his life that emancipation should be accompanied by colonization. His ideas had evolved to the point where he supported some very progressive measures. When asked in 1864 to deliver a legal opinion on the controversial question of the unequal pay scale for black soldiers, he declared unhesitatingly that persons of color who were performing in the field the same duties as their white counterparts should receive the same pay, bounty, and clothing. Abolitionists applauded this opinion, along with an earlier one declaring blacks to be citizens of the United States. The citizenship issue had arisen when a commercial schooner plying the coastal trade was detained because its captain was a black man. The Dred Scott decision had declared that blacks were not citizens, and naval law required one to be a citizen to command a ship flying the American flag. When the question was put to him, Bates carefully researched definitions of citizenship dating back to Greek and Roman times. After much consideration, he concluded that place of birth, not color of skin, determined citizenship. The Dred Scott decision was wrong. Free blacks were citizens of the United States. Bates's decision did not cover the status of slaves, nor did it suggest that citizenship implied the right of suffrage or the right to sit on juries. Nonetheless, as a local Washington paper noted at the time of his resignation, though esteemed by many as more conservative than the majority of his countrymen at the present day, Mr. Bates has given opinions involving the rights of the colored race which have been quite abreast with the times, and which will henceforth stand as landmarks of constitutional interpretation. From their first acquaintance, the relationship between Bates and Lincoln had been marked by warmth and cordiality. On occasion, Bates's diary reveals frustration with Lincoln's loose management style, which left the administration with no system, no unity, no accountability, no subordination. He believed Lincoln relied too heavily on Seward and Stanton. He could not fathom why the disloyal Chase had been kept in place for so long, or why General Butler was not fired when complaints arose about his arbitrary arrests in Norfolk. In fact, Bates confided in his diary, his chief fear was the president's easy good nature. Nonetheless, by the end of his tenure as Attorney General, Bates had formed a more spacious understanding of the president's unique leadership style. While troubled at the start by Lincoln's never-failing fund of anecdote, he had come to realize that storytelling played a central role in the president's ability to communicate with the public. "The character of the president's mind is such," Bates remarked, "that his thought habitually takes on this form of illustration, by which the point he wishes to enforce is invariably brought home with a strength and clearness impossible in hours of abstract argument." "Mr. Lincoln," Bates told Francis Carpenter, "comes very near being a perfect man, according to my ideal of manhood. He lacks but one thing, the element of will. I have sometimes told him, for instance, that he was unfit to be entrusted with the pardoning power. Why, if a man comes to him with a touching story, his judgment is almost certain to be affected by it. Should the applicant be a woman, a wife, a mother, or a sister, in 9 cases out of 10, her tears, if nothing else, are sure to prevail." As Bates prepared to leave Washington, each of his colleagues stopped to say goodbye, in contrast to the lonely leave-taking endured by Salmon Chase. "Stanton was especially civil," Bates noted, "told me to write to my sons in the army and assure them that he would do anything for them that they would expect me to do." Bates joined Seward, Wells, and Usher in the president's office for a pleasant farewell. The departing attorney general was once again touched by the president's affable and kind manner. Bates left his colleagues and staff with regret, but with the knowledge that his life was forever connected with the history of his country. Because Lincoln had chosen him as his attorney general, Edward Bates had been able to leave a trail which might make known that I once lived when I am gone. To replace Bates, Lincoln felt he had to find a man from one of the border states. "My cabinet has shrunk up north, and I must find a southern man," he explained to a colleague. I suppose if the 12 apostles were to be chosen nowadays, the shrieks of locality would have to be heeded. His first choice was Judge Advocate General Joseph Holt. The native Kentuckian had been one of the trio of cabinet members, together with Edwin Stanton and Jeremiah Black, who had stiffened Buchanan's will to resist secession. Lincoln liked and respected Judge Holt, having worked closely with him on court-martial cases. Holt declined the offer, however, recommending instead his fellow Kentuckian, James Speed, the older brother of Lincoln's great friend Joshua. I can recall no public man in the state of uncompromising loyalty, Holt told Lincoln, who unites in the same degree the qualifications of professional attainments, fervent devotion to the Union and to the principles of your administration, and spotless points of personal character. Lincoln followed Holt's recommendation that very day, sending a telegram to Speed. I appoint you to be Attorney General. Please come on at once. Though taken by surprise, Speed was honored to accept. We'll leave tomorrow for Washington. James Speed would prove to be an excellent choice. Over the years, he had arrived at a radical position on slavery. The previous spring, he and his brother Joshua had been instrumental in forming a new liberal party in conservative Kentucky, the Unconditional Union Party, which supported Lincoln's re-election and emancipation. I am a thorough constitutional abolitionist, James Speed had declared during the fall campaign, meaning he, like Lincoln, was for abolishing slavery under the war power of the national constitution, and then clinching it by a constitutional amendment prohibiting it everywhere forever. Though unable to swing the state for Lincoln, the unconditionalists remained hopeful that they might eventually direct Kentucky's future. We are less now, but true, James Speed had written Lincoln after the election. To those unfamiliar with the Louisville lawyer, Lincoln explained that Speed was a man I know well, though not so well as I know his brother Joshua. That, however, is not strange, for I slept with Joshua for 4 years, and I suppose I ought to know him well. Lincoln's ease in referring to his sleeping arrangement with Joshua Speed is further evidence that theirs was not a sexual relationship. Had it been, historian David Donald suggests, the president would not have spoken of it so freely and publicly. You will find, Lincoln predicted as James Speed set out for Washington, he is one of those well-poised men, not too common here, who are not spoiled by a big office. The ease with which Lincoln filled the post of Attorney General was not replicated when Roger Taney's death in mid-October left vacant the seat of Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Though Lincoln had initially planned to offer Salmon Chase the position, he discovered that three of his most loyal cabinet members, Edwin Stanton, Edward Bates, and Montgomery Blair, desired the honored post for themselves. He decided to postpone his choice until after the election. Stanton's claim seemed the most compelling. The chief justiceship was the only position, observed a longtime friend, Stanton ever desired. His brilliant legal career had brought him to argue numerous cases before the Supreme Court. Lifetime tenure would secure his family's finances, which had diminished seriously during the war. His unstable health might be restored, with the pressures of the War Office removed. You have been wearing out your life in the service of your country and have fulfilled the duties of your very responsible and laborious office with unexampled ability, wrote his friend, the Supreme Court Justice Robert Greer. Though Greer himself was an obvious choice to fill Taney's position, he believed Stanton deserved the honor. It would give me the greatest pleasure and satisfaction, he wrote Stanton, to have you preside on our bench. I think the Prez owes it to you. Ellen Stanton, doubtless acting at her husband's behest, invited Orville Browning to their house one Sunday night when Stanton was at City Point. "She expressed to me a great desire to have her husband appointed Chief Justice," Browning recorded in his diary, "and wished me to see the President upon the subject. I fear Mr. Chase's appointment, and am anxious to prevent it. Mr. Stanton is an able lawyer, learned in his profession and fond of it, of great application and capacity of endurance in labor. I think a just man, honest and upright, and incapable of corruption, and I therefore think would be an appointment most fit to be made. I will see the President upon the subject tomorrow." Methodist Bishop Matthew Simpson also called on Lincoln to urge Stanton's appointment on the grounds of his fitness and as a reward for his services and labors. Lincoln listened attentively, and then, throwing his leg over a chair and running his hands through his hair, responded with heartfelt emotion, "Bishop, I believe every word you have said. But where can I get a man to take Secretary Stanton's place? Tell me that, and I will do it." Like Lincoln, General Grant worried about losing Stanton's indispensable talents in the War Department. At City Point, he urged the secretary to stay at his post. The strain of the situation likely contributed to Stanton's ongoing illness that fall. In the end, Stanton informed Lincoln, through a friend, that he should no longer be considered among candidates. He felt that the completion of the work he had in hand, his sister Pamphila recalled, was nearer to his heart and a far higher ambition. A heartfelt note from Henry Ward Beecher helped to dispel Stanton's disappointment at relinquishing his ambition. "The country cannot spare your services from your present place," wrote the celebrated minister. "Or I could wish that you might redeem Tawney's place and restore to that court the honor and trust of Marshall's day. I regard your administration of the War Department, from whatever point it is viewed, as one of the greatest features of this grand time. Your energy, vitalizing industry, and fidelity, but above all, your moral vision, are just as sure to give your name honor and fame. If you were to die tomorrow, you have done enough for your own fame already." In an emotional reply, Stanton told Beecher that he was deeply moved by his generous remarks. "Often, in dark hours, you have come before me, and I have longed to hear your voice, feeling that above all other men you could cheer, strengthen, guide, and uphold me in this great battle, where by God's providence it has fallen upon me to hold a post and perform a duty beyond my own strength. But being a stranger, I had no right to claim your confidence or ask for help. Now, my dear sir, your voice has reached me, and your hand is stretched forth as to a friend. Already my heart feels renewed strength and is inspired with fresh hope." Montgomery Blair desired the post of Chief Justice even more fervently than Stanton. He had gracefully acceded to Lincoln's request for his resignation, but the high appointment would certainly compensate for the remnant wound. His distinguished career as a lawyer had been defined by his eloquent representation of the slave Dred Scott in the case that had forever cast a blight on Justice Tawney's name. Monty had powerful backers, including Seward, Weed, and Wells, all of whom vastly preferred him to Chase. Wells told Lincoln that of all the candidates, Blair best conformed to these requirements, that the President knew the man, his ability, his truthfulness, honesty, and courage. Lincoln expressed his concurrence, and spoke kindly and complimentarily of Mr. Blair, but did not in any way commit himself, nor did I expect or suppose he would. Lincoln understood that the appointment mattered greatly, not only to Monty, but to his father, who had taken his son's forced resignation as a personal blow. A week after Tawney died, the elder Blair wrote Lincoln an impassioned plea. "I beg you to indulge me with a little conference with you on paper about a thing which, as involving a good deal of egotism, I am ashamed to talk about face to face." He went on to describe the Blairs' enduring loyalty to both the Union and the President. "Now I come," he pressed, "to what I hope you will consider another and higher opportunity of serving you and the Republic by carrying your political principles and the support of your policy expressed in relation to the reconstruction of the Union and the support of the Freedmen's Proclamation into the Supreme Court. I think Montgomery's unswerving support of your administration in all its aspects, coupled with his unfaltering attachment to you personally, fits him to be your representative man at the head of that bench." When Mary Lincoln warned old man Blair that "Chase and his friends are besieging my husband for the chief justiceship," Blair discarded his embarrassment and requested a personal interview. Lincoln listened graciously as Monty's father suggested that his son had been tried as a judge and not found wanting, that his practice in the West had made him conversant with our land law, Spanish law, as well as the common and civil law in which his university studies had grounded him, that his practice in the Supreme Court brought him into the circle of commercial and constitutional questions, that, besides, on political issues he sustained him, the President, in everything. And when Chase and every other member of the cabinet declined to make war for Sumter, Montgomery stood by him. Lincoln agreed that Monty would admirably acquit himself as Chief Justice, but he was also aware that the nomination would produce a storm of criticism from his many enemies in the Congress. He had no desire to provoke unnecessary animosity among the radicals, who probably held sufficient power to deny confirmation. Nor did Lincoln trust where Monty Blair's conservative philosophy would lead on issues surrounding Reconstruction and the integration of the country's new black citizens. The same objections most likely applied to Edward Bates. Believing the post would be a crowning and retiring honor, Bates had personally solicited Lincoln to consider his name. "If not overborne by others," Lincoln told Bates, "he would happily consider him for the post, but Chase was turning every stone to get it, and several others were urged from different quarters." Hearing this, Bates declared himself happy in the feeling that the failure to get the place will be no painful disappointment, for my mind is made up to private life. In the end, Lincoln returned to his first impulse upon learning of Roger Tawney's illness, Salmon P. Chase. "Of Mr. Chase's ability and of his soundness on the general issues of the war, there is, of course, no question," he told Chase's friend Henry Wilson. "I have only one doubt about his appointment. He is a man of unbounded ambition and has been working all his life to become president. That he can never be, and I fear that if I make him Chief Justice, he will simply become more restless and uneasy, and neglect the place in his strife and intrigue to make himself president. If I were sure that he would go on the bench and give up his aspirations, and do nothing but make himself a great judge, I would not hesitate a moment." He made a similar comment when Schuyler Colfax gave his word that Chase would dedicate the remainder of his life to the bench. When supporters of other candidates reminded the president of Chase's myriad intrigues against him, Lincoln responded, "Now, I know meaner things about Governor Chase than any of those men can tell me. But we have stood together in the time of trial, and I should despise myself if I allowed personal differences to affect my judgment of his fitness for the office." Chase remained in Ohio throughout this tumult, confident that the nomination would be his. Oblivious to Stanton's own hopes, he told the War Secretary, 2 days after Tawney's death, that, "within the last 3 or 4 months, I have been assured that it was the President's intention to offer the place to me in case of a vacancy. I think I should accept it, if offered, for I am weary of political life and work." However, when weeks passed with no word from the President, Chase anxiously decided to come to Washington. Fessenden and Sumner assured him that the appointment would be made as soon as the elections were over, but Lincoln waited until December 6th to announce his choice. That morning, Chase's friend John Alley of Massachusetts had called on the President. "I have something to tell you that will make you happy," Lincoln announced. "I have just sent Mr. Chase word that he is to be appointed Chief Justice, and you are the first man I have told of it." Alley enthusiastically replied, "Mr. President, this is an exhibition of magnanimity and patriotism that could hardly be expected of anyone. After what he has said against your administration, which has undoubtedly been reported to you, it was hardly to be expected that you would bestow the most important office within your gift on such a man." "To have done otherwise, I should have been recreant to my convictions of duty to the Republican Party and to the country," Lincoln answered. "As to his talk about me, I do not mind that. Chase is, on the whole, a pretty good fellow, and a very able man. His only trouble is that he has the White House fever a little too bad, but I hope this may cure him, and that he will be satisfied." Lincoln later told Senator Chandler that, personally, he would rather have swallowed his buckhorn chair than to have nominated Chase. But the decision was right for the country. "Probably no other man than Lincoln," Nicolay wrote to Thurina, "would have had in this age of the world the degree of magnanimity to thus forgive and exalt a rival who had so deeply and so unjustifiably intrigued against him. It is, however, only another most marked illustration of the greatness of the President." Chase got the official word from Kate when he arrived home that night. He immediately sat down to write the President. "I cannot sleep before I thank you for this mark of your confidence. Be assured that I prize your confidence and goodwill more than nomination or office." On December 15th, the Supreme Court was overflowing with an immense throng of dignitaries of various degrees, ladies, congressmen, foreign ministers, and others who wished to view the simple but impressive ceremony of swearing in the Chief Judicial Officer of the Republic. Kate Sprague and her sister Nettie were there, gorgeously dressed, according to Noah Brooks. Secretary Seward was also present, along with Nathaniel Banks, Ben Wade, Reverdy Johnson, and Charles Sumner, whose handsome features plainly showed his inward glow of gratification. At the usher's solemn announcement, everyone stood as the robed justices entered the room. The senior justice, James W. Wayne, administered the oath, which Chase read in a clear but tremulous voice. When he finished, Chase lifted his right hand, looked upward to the beautiful dome of the courtroom, and with deep feeling added, "So help me God." "I hope the President may have no occasion to regret his selection," Gideon Wells confided in his diary, sharing Lincoln's apprehension that Chase would use the place for political advancement and thereby endanger confidence in the court. Still, Lincoln believed the risk worth taking. He trusted that Chase would help secure the rights of the black man, for which he had fought throughout his career, a belief that outweighed concerns about Chase's restless temperament. Chase quickly justified Lincoln's confidence in this regard. Within hours of Chase's accession to the court, John Rock, a black lawyer from Massachusetts, wrote a hopeful letter to Charles Sumner. Rock had been seeking to practice before the Supreme Court for over a year, but his efforts had been denied on the basis of his race. "We now have a great and good man for our Chief Justice, and with him, I think, my color will not be a bar to my admission," he wrote. Sumner immediately contacted Chase, who was delighted to pursue the cause of opening the court to its first black barrister. 6 weeks later, Sumner stood before the Supreme Court as Rock's sponsor. "May it please the court, I move that John S. Rock, a member of the Supreme Court of the State of Massachusetts, be admitted to practice as a member of this court." Then, with Chase's assent, Rock stepped forward for the oath that would allow him to practice before the highest court in the land. "This event," Harper's Weekly observed, "represented an extraordinary reversal of the decision in the Dred Scott case. Rock's admission," Harper predicted, "would be regarded by the future historian as a remarkable indication of the revolution which is going on in the sentiment of a great people." Mary Lincoln took special satisfaction in her husband's re-election. "The White House has been quite a mecca of late," she wrote to her friend Mercy Conkling. "We are surrounded at all times by a great deal of company, and it has been gratifying from all quarters to receive so many kind and congratulatory letters, so fraught with good feeling." Mary's pleasure in her husband's victory reflected more than simple pride. During the fall election, she had been terrified that his defeat might signal merchants in New York and Philadelphia, to whom she still owed substantial sums, to call in her debt. "I owe altogether about $27,000, she confided in Elizabeth Keckley. "Mr. Lincoln has but little idea of the expense of a woman's wardrobe. He glances at my rich dresses and is happy in the belief that the few $100 that I obtain from him supply all my wants. I must dress in costly materials. The people scrutinize every article that I wear with critical curiosity. The very fact of having grown up in the West subjects me to more searching observation. To keep up appearances, I must have money, more than Mr. Lincoln can spare for me. He is too honest to make a penny outside of his salary. Consequently, I had and still have no alternative but to run in debt." Although padded bills and attempts to trade upon her White House influence exposed her to serious scandal, Mary could not curtail her excessive spending habits. "Here is the carriage of Mrs. Lincoln before a dry goods store," Judge Taft noted 4 weeks after the election. "Her footman has gone into the store. The clerk is just going out to the carriage, where Mrs. L. is waiting, with some pieces of goods for her to choose from. I should rather think that she would have a better chance at the goods if she was to go into the store. But then she might get jostled and gazed at, and that, too, would be doing just as the common people do. The footman holds the carriage door open. The driver sits on the box and holds the horses. Mrs. L. thumbs the goods and asks a great many questions." A week later, Mary journeyed to Philadelphia for another shopping trip. Not long afterward, she visited New York, where she purchased a new dress, expensive furs, and 300 pairs of kid gloves. When the items she purchased did not measure up to her expectations, her manic sprees quickly gave way to depression and anger. "I can neither wear or settle with you for my bonnet without different inside flowers," she threatened a milliner in New York. "I cannot retain or wear the bonnet as it is. I am certainly taught a lesson by your acting thus." Mary's self-conscious attention to the details of her bonnet was not entirely misplaced. Newspaper reports of her evening receptions invariably commented on every piece of her apparel. At the first White House levee of the new winter season, the National Republican noted that she was charmingly and elegantly attired, dressed in a rich, plain white silk, with heavy black lace flounce and black lace shawl, and upon her head was a coronet of white and purple flowers, a most tasteful decoration. Her outfit at a state dinner a few weeks later drew equal praise. "Mrs. Lincoln was tastefully attired in a heavy black and white spotted silk, elegantly trimmed with black lace, her headdress and rich set of jewelry harmonizing throughout." The new season brought new rules of etiquette for visitors at public receptions at the White House. Overcoats, hats, caps, bonnets, shawls, cloaks, etc., should be deposited in the several anterooms provided for that purpose, and where they will be in charge of proper persons for safekeeping. The new arrangement pleased the Washington social elite, who began returning to the open receptions they had shunned. A reporter for the National Republican noted, on the part of all the guests, a more general observance of the proprieties of dress and demeanor, which seemed to suggest increasing respect for the president, his family, and themselves. Mary also took great pride in her informal Blue Room receptions, which continued to draw distinguished visitors. She was particularly gratified by the regular appearance of Charles Sumner. The handsome senator, though in his early 50s, was considered one of the most eligible bachelors in Washington. "I was pleased," Mary later recalled, "knowing he visited no other lady. His time was so immersed in his business. And that cold and haughty-looking man, to the world, would insist upon my telling him all the news, and we would have such frequent and delightful conversations, and often late in the evening. My darling husband would join us, and they would laugh together like two schoolboys." However, the prestige and pleasure of her second term as First Lady could not assuage Mary's lingering grief over the loss of Willie. Over 2 years after her son's death, it was still difficult for her to enter the library, which had been one of his favorite rooms. Her darling boy, the idolized child of the household, was never far from her mind. "I have sometimes feared," she admitted to a friend, "that the deep waters through which we have passed would overwhelm me. In the absence of her gentle son, the world has lost so much of its charm. My position requires my presence where my heart is so far from being." After Willie's death, Mary had been determined not to allow her oldest son, Robert, to risk his life in the army. But after his graduation from Harvard, she could no longer detain him. In January 1865, Lincoln wrote to General Grant, "Please read and answer this letter as though I was not president, but only a friend. My son, now in his 22nd year, having graduated at Harvard, wishes to see something of the war before it ends. I do not wish to put him in the ranks, nor yet to give him a commission, to which those who have already served long are better entitled and better qualified to hold. Could he, without embarrassment to you, or detriment to the service, go into your military family with some nominal rank, I, and not the public, furnishing his necessary means? If no, say so without the least hesitation, because I am as anxious and as deeply interested that you shall not be encumbered." Grant replied 2 days later, "I will be most happy to have him in my military family," he wrote. He suggested that the rank of captain would be most appropriate. So Robert's wish to join the army was granted. Stationed at Grant's headquarters, Robert soon became exceedingly popular, Horace Porter recalled. "He was always ready to perform his share of hard work, and never expected to be treated differently from any other officer on account of his being the son of the chief executive of the nation." In the first days of 1865, Gideon Welles was preoccupied with thoughts of passing time and accumulating years. His wistful contemplation was shared by Salmon Chase. On the 1st of January, the Chief Justice's last surviving sister, Helen, was buried in Ohio. Of 10 siblings, only Chase and his brother Edward, both in their mid-50s,